The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Mark Efron. Mark is the founder and president of the Talent Strategy Group, where he leads the firm's global consulting, education, executive search, and publishing businesses. He founded and publishes Talent Quarterly magazine and is the co-author of the best-selling Harvard Business Review Press book, One Page Talent Management. He also co-founded the Talent Management Institute at the University of North Carolina. Previously, Mark served as vice president, talent management for Avon Products and led the global leadership consulting practice for Aon Hewitt. He was a senior VP for Bank of America, as well as a congressional staff assistant. He has a new book. It's called Steps to High Performance, Focusing on What You Can Change, Ignore the Rest. Mark Efron, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Kelly. Happy to be here.
So I saw a piece yesterday by Susan Pinker in the Wall Street Journal, and she writes, quote, "I'd always thought our need for sleep was a personal matter. Wrong. A new study of the sleep habits of more than 10,000 people around the world suggests that the amount of sleep adults need is universal." And she goes on to note that when individuals get less than 7 or 8 hours of sleep, it stints their ability to be creative, to innovate, and to be successful. And I thought this would resonate for you, and it also proves that I read to the end of your book.
Which is, well, at least in chapter 7, which we'll give you credit for, okay, for almost all the 8 steps. And one of the most interesting things in doing all the research for the book, and I read through 2,000 academic articles to get to the 8 steps in the book, and if you've ever read through an academic article, you would understand the pain, yep, that 2,000 of them would cause. And it was interesting how conclusive the science is around sleep. And what's interesting to the article you mentioned yesterday is we also need to think of sleep in terms of both quality and quantity, and lack of each of those affects us in different ways. So we can dig into that. But yeah, what we found was that sleep is really the foundation to high performance. All the other 8 steps that I talk about in the book are going to be far less effective if you don't have the right quality of sleep.
There's a number of these things in the book which I found really interesting, and it's almost like good starter points, like what we begin with. So just like the need for sleep is universal, you talk about other things that are just as true about people. One thing you say is that some people begin with a clear head start. Unpack that for our audience.
Sure. I talk about at the beginning of the book what I call the fixed 50% and the flexible 50%. Fixed 50%, flexible 50%. What that says is that about 50% of our performance at work is due to things that we simply can't control. Personal things like our intelligence, our personality. Not our behaviors, but our personality. Our socioeconomic background. Were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth, or did you have a more disadvantaged upbringing? Even our appearance. All of those things which are natural to us, we can't do a darned thing to control once we're in the working world. That's the fixed 50, as the subtitle of the book suggests. Ignore what you can't change. The flexible 50, though, is the other 50% that we have direct control over, and that's what the 8 steps to high performance are all about, is to say what scientifically, conclusively, rock-solid proven to help you be a higher performer, and that all of us can completely control.
Yeah, and you bring this up, and I've read the science about this because I, like you, have nerded out on many of these academic journals, but like height correlates to higher income. I also found it fascinating that if you peak too early, like popularity too young is actually often bad in terms of predicting future success.
Yeah, Absolutely. There's to the height piece, just as an aside, it is interesting. There's research that shows there's about a 1% premium in your compensation for each extra inch of height you are above average. So tall people rejoice and short people are really sorry. But yeah, it definitely suggests that there are parts of our physical appearance that directly affect how we're perceived at work.
Here's the thing I was really excited to talk to you about. There is science essentially behind the term fake it till you make it, right?
There is a ton of science around it. And let's start with the challenge that over the past number of years, the whole concept of being an authentic or a genuine leader has become a big deal, a number of bestsellers written around it. And while I'm sure that all of your listeners are wonderful, authentic, genuine human beings, it is just possible that not every single one of their genuine behaviors is perfect every single moment in every single interaction that they have with others, and that there might be some times when a different behavior than their genuine behavior is going to be what's most important. And that really comes to the chapter on faking it. And the chapter on faking it is very clear that high performers are going to walk into a room and not say, I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to be the genuine me. They're going to observe that room or that setting and say, who does this group need to see right now? Who do they, what behaviors do they need from me? What leadership they need from me? High performers are always trying to understand how do they best apply themselves. And the analogy I use is, and I write about this in the book, high performers are really like chameleons. Mm-hmm. They're going to understand and adapt to their surroundings. The other option, if you're not a chameleon, is you're a bit of a bull. A bull just charges into a room and says, hey, I'm here. I'm the bull. It's me. I'm not going to change. Science is very clear. High performers are going to be chameleons and adapt. And part of that might be fundamentally faking a behavior that you're not comfortable with. And it's really putting on that actor's face and saying, in a situation where I might naturally feel very uncomfortable, engaging in a behavior that I know will make me a higher performer, I might need to fake that behavior. And that might be something like being really nice to your boss.
Right.
Now, we write about... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're right. That's 100%. I mean, I think this is a problem we get because you do want people. Science also tells us this, right? We can experience someone's authentic self, and that's pleasing to us. Knowing details about them, all that's true. But having the toggle switch to be able to up or lessen whether it's your status or what you truly believe, we do that in tons of different social situations, and it amazes me that more people don't realize that you need to do that in a business situation to be just as successful.
Absolutely. And the research is clear. One, flattery works and people love flattery. So yeah. I could say 10 times during this podcast, Kelly, this is the best podcast I have ever been on. This is just a fascinating set of questions. And by the fourth time I say that, you'll think, okay, he's kind of shunning me on here. But the research would say you still won't care.
Right.
You'll think, well, he's going a bit over the top, but I am actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yep, 100%. Okay, and also, the way our brain is wired also factors into this. A few of these items that you talk about are really interesting. And one is, quote, you say, your brain's attempt to preserve your self-image creates some very challenging barriers to improve your performance. So how does that work? How am I be screwing up my performance because of my brain's attempt to protect my self-image?
Sure. So let's go back to the assumption that all of us can probably adjust a behavior or two to be more effective. Mm-hmm. The only way we're going to know which behaviors to change to be more effective is to find out from others. The challenge with our brain is hardwired to preserve our self-image, meaning we're not hardwired to go around asking people, hey, how can I be better at X tomorrow? Because most of the time, we don't really want to hear the answer. Our brains are listening for information instead that confirms our self-image. Mark, you're a wonderful, generous human being who's kind to children and animals. That's what our brains absorb, is any information that confirms that self-view. And our brains literally either sometimes don't even hear information that conflicts with that self-image, don't process it, or just excuse it away. Oh, I know Kelly said I wasn't nice to children and animals, but he doesn't know me well enough to really assess that. And so because our brains work so hard to protect our self-image, it's very difficult for us to absorb feedback in a productive way to say, well, actually, the way that Kelly pointed it out, I probably could give a little bit more to animal charities next year. I have the wherewithal. So the challenge is that you have to be very conscious in asking people, hey, how can I be a better performer at work, and be okay recognizing, yeah, there's probably something you can improve. Ask someone, they'll be happy to tell you.
So this feedback thing is hugely important, I think, mostly because we do it so poorly, and the way we frame the conversation is often bad. When we have the conversation is often bad. It doesn't meet the science that we understand. You say, quote, feedback increases performance, and the best results come when the feedback is about activities, not behaviors. And this is, I think, tied to the idea of feed forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take each of those separately. So the activities versus behavior, if we're making widgets together and I say, hey, Kelly, you're going to get another widget an hour done if you actually rotate them this way as opposed to the other way, you'll likely say, okay, cool, thanks, I appreciate that. You won't be defensive and say, I'm the best widget rotator on the line, because I'm going to help you be a better performer. But if I say, hey, Kelly, you should really be nicer to Marcy in the break room. You seem to be a little gruff with her. That feels like more of an affront to who you are, because that reflects your behaviors. So part of that challenge is we are much more likely to accept feedback about very tangible, observable things and things that feel more personal to us, like how we interact with people.
Yeah, and then feed forward is a framing device as well, right? That's got a little bit of twist on that.
Exactly. So what, take those behaviors where we might naturally not want to hear people give us advice and twist that to say, I'm not going to critique Kelly for what he did in the past. I'm not going to say, hey, you know, I've seen you four times in the break room, be kind of mean to Marcy. What I would do is focus that behavior forward. Instead of saying, hey, you did X things wrong in the past, because our brains don't deal well with that, we can't resolve things that happened in the past, I would say something like, hey, Kelly, you know what? Marcy actually is interested in the Cubs as well. You might want to talk to her about next season, because I know she's a big Cubs fan. Something that helps you to think through it. Going forward, how could I engage in a behavior or engage with a person differently than I did in the past? And the psychology is really powerful. You don't need to know what you did wrong in the past in order to change a behavior in the future. And that's what gets in the way of feedback, is this mistaken belief that Kelly needs to understand what he's doing wrong before he changes. No, he doesn't. He can simply change for the better.
Yep. One of our buddies up at the University of Chicago, a behavioral scientist, fell in love with improv and did a bunch of improv classes. And I was talking to him about our work at Second City, and when we're creating a show and we're improvising in front of the audience and we're generating material in front of an audience and we're kind of crowdsourcing the effectiveness of that material based on whether they're laughing or not laughing, and the actors make that adjustment in the moment. And it's this very organic, present kind of feedback loop that has been very positive for us. And you have a terrific analogy for this that's different from a theatrical context. You talk about the spoken driving directions in your phone. And it's not a steady stream of information. It's just the right directions delivered when you actually need it most.
Exactly. So think of, you've Google mapped yourself from one place to the next. Google Maps, when we think about feedback, sometimes we think, oh, well, someone's going to be in my ear all the time. No, it's just the right information at the right time. Hey, exit coming up in 2 miles. Oh, cool, thanks. Now I know about the exit. It's not annoying, it's helpful. How can you structure feedback in that exact same way? So if you know that one of your direct reports is going to a big meeting and you're pretty sure you know a piece of advice that will help them, give them that feed forward. Hey, I know you're going into a meeting with Susie. Hey, one thing Susie really cares about is X. So you want to make sure that you focus on X during the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Just enough information at the right time to help sustain your high performance.
And feedback goes both ways. So you also have a terrific line that I agree with, which is, when you finish listening, just say thank you. And we have this thing where it's like, just take the note. You don't have to believe in the note. You don't have to care about the note. But when someone's giving you the note and this sort of a director to an actor, just take the note, say thank you, and you can incorporate what you think is important from that note in your future performance, or take elements of it. And too often, the minute we start fighting the note, which is our natural inclination in feedback sessions, we're lost. We're not hearing anything.
Well, and it also shuts down the person who's giving you that helpful information. Yeah. And that line comes from a brilliant executive coach named Marshall Goldsmith, who wrote a great book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And he points out very helpfully, the moment I critique Kelly's helpful suggestions to me is when Kelly thinks, this guy is never going to get another suggestion from me because he appears not to value them.
Right.
We don't need to do everything that people tell us, but we can certainly just say, hey, thanks for the suggestion. Add it to our list. If we feel like doing it, do it.
Let's talk a bit about some of the behavior work. I was surprised by this. You say, quote, conscientiousness is the personality factor that most influences your performance. It's twice as powerful as any other factor. Why so?
Sure. Quick primer on personality. I'll try and keep it non-academic. If you think about your personality, you can slice it into five buckets. You don't need to know about most of them, but there is one element called conscientiousness. Think of it as the stick-to-itiveness part of personality, which means these are the folks who just wake up every morning and say, what can I get done? Wow, can't wait to get to work, or can't wait to start working on that project, and I'm going to make sure it's done right. Now, those people are annoying to some of us, but they're also high performers because they're just naturally wired to get tasks done. Now, that goes back to the fixed 50. You cannot develop conscientiousness. You can certainly work harder and try and be more dedicated to a task, but some people are just naturally hardwired around that. But it goes to, don't worry about it. If you're high on that, great. If you're low on that, then come up with compensating strategies, but you're not going to be able to change your core level of a personality characteristic.
You also note something that Bob Sutton at Stanford has talked about in his legendary book, The No Asshole Rule, that if you are unethical, if you're not honest, if you're not fair, if you scream, if you steal or you lie or cheat, that is not sustainable high performance. It could be in the short term, but it's not long term.
Yeah, and I'm really clear in the book. It's about, if your baseline behaviors aren't there, just don't waste your time with the other eight steps. You can do all of them perfectly, but if you engage in the behaviors you just mentioned, it doesn't matter anyway. So kind of try and have that good raw material of a decent, hardworking individual, then apply the eight steps on top of that.
You also talk about a couple different ways that people sort of enter the leadership space, and it's transformation leaders and then performance drivers. And they're different, right? And I think they correlate to probably what you feel your best practices are. Talk to us about the transformation leaders.
Sure. Well, one of the really interesting things that I found in digging in all this literature was a lot of us have this stereotypical view of what a good leader is, what a good leader does. And there's a lot of research that backs that up. And that's called it's captured in what's called a transformational leader model. And these people are inspirational. They have a clear vision. They pay attention to their direct reports. And that's certainly one way of getting a higher performance. But it's not the only way. There's another model that says that actually people who just give others big challenging goals and drive for high results get great results as well. And I think what it shows is there's kind of, and I'll call it a Steve Jobs model. Steve Jobs, as I pointed out in the book, and most of us know, was a horrid manager. Mm-hmm. Probably, his biographer said, probably one of the worst managers in history. But what he did was give people unbelievably high goals with unbelievably high standards and allow them to do something brilliant. And that's actually an okay model with the right people. So part of understanding how do I behave to be a high performer is to understand in this situation which model is going to work best, but also realize there's not one path to success. The converse of that, we can talk about this more as well, is the good news is we also know how we're likely to fail. So there are a few limited ways to succeed, but also a few limited ways to fail, and the sooner we know that, the sooner we can correct those.
Here's another thing, too, that was really interesting in this particular chapter was this idea of other people's opinions actually matter a ton because they're the ones who are deciding whether you're considered a high performer. You don't just get to put that stamp on your forehead.
Yeah, boss and peers. So the boss one is easy. Most of us understand that, although most of us don't manage our relationship with our boss quite as well as we should. It's helpful to remember that bosses are people, too. Mm-hmm. And because they're people, sometimes they like being complimented. They like being asked for their opinions. They like being told they're doing a good job. there is a lot of gray space between being a total suck-up and being nice to your boss. And I think people sometimes confound one with the other. You can treat your boss like a human being, ask what kind of weekend cheer he had, and build a strong, positive relationship. The science would say that people who have strong personal relationships with their boss are actually rated higher on performance reviews and get more promotions than other people. Now, just having a good relationship and not performing isn't a good long-term strategy, but the science does say that warm personal relationship gives you a bit of a performance bump. Where we tend to, what we tend to forget is that peer relationship. Peers are not going to get us promoted, but they can certainly hold us back. Our peers can either say good things about us or not so good things about us. And what I talk about in the book in our chapter on connecting is for your boss and for all of your peers, you should have a set strategy for how you're going to maintain a brilliant relationship with each of them. And there's a chart in the book you can use and you can download from the website that, where you can rate the relationship and chart out what is my plan for ensuring that the relationship with that person stays very strong. And I say, look at your peers today, rate them high, medium, low. If there's anybody rated medium or low, in the next 3 weeks, you should be having a coffee with them, a lunch with them, a real get-to-know conversation. Because the stronger those relationships are, the higher performer you're going to be perceived as.
Yeah, the connecting chapter really spoke to me. I was in a conversation a long while ago with the late director Harold Ramis, and someone had asked him for, like, advice in terms of, you know, when I'm breaking into the industry, what are the best practices? And he said, okay, so if you're like taking an improv class or an acting class or whatever, find the most talented person in the room and stand next to them. And in his case, that was John Belushi. So he was in an improv class with John Belushi. He saw what that guy could do, and he just tailed him. And they ended up having an incredible relationship. And you kind of talk about that in the book, that this idea of connecting with the best, hang out with the people who are better than you.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you're reviewing those peer relationships, you're going to notice that some of those folks are high performers. They really should be your best friends. Now, part of it is simply the appearance of, hey, he hangs out with other high performers. Part of it is you might actually get some interesting wisdom from them, either actively or passively, by observing how they work, observing how they interact with people, observing the relationships they build. They're high performers for a reason, and it's probably not just because they suck up better than you do.
I'm curious in your personal path. So I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you spent a long time in business doing your stuff, being a good and bad leader like all of us, and then discovered these sort of academic insights and it lit a fire and you dug in deeper. Is that correct how that worked?
Consider it a very gradual slope up. So it was funny, I got to business school many, many, many years ago, and I had zero kind of academic-y background, and I saw an academic journal for the first time. And for your listeners who aren't familiar, academic journals were filled with lots of kind of geeky articles on subjects that, you know, kind of dig in really deep. And I just thought, wow, there's all this cool information out there. Why aren't people using it? And it just became a larger and larger theme as I moved to the corporate world that I recognized that there's a ton of science that tells us exactly how to be successful, and we regularly ignore that science. And so I applied it on the corporate side, but then when I started my consulting firm, I guess 9 years ago now when my last book came out, really said, let's turn the dial on the science up really high and make sure that folks understand that a lot of the answers we're looking for exist, and then just making it really easy to apply those.
Yeah, and I think the problem you've got, it's multifold. One, you have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of firewalls between, you know, academic journals and people who might want to read them. That's one problem. And to keep the rigor of the science often requires you to lose the poetry of storytelling that where people can kind of understand what's going on. And it's rare. I mean, I remember slogging through Danny Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, which I think is maybe one of the most important books of the modern era, but it's a really hard read. It's probably easier, you know, to read Michael Lewis's version of Kahneman and Tversky and get to mm-hmm. the ideas through that. So that's hard. And you bring this up because, you know, all our academic friends just hate Malcolm Gladwell because they feel like he's such a good storyteller, he's confusing the science.
Yeah, so we can probably unpack that a little bit. I think there is a lot of challenge in translating the academic work into stuff that the average Jill or Joe can apply. What I've tried to do is I read those things looking for what I call gold bricks.
Yeah.
I want to build a nice high gold wall, but no one's ever just shown me a gold wall that I can take and apply. But in almost all those academic articles, there's a little gold brick, a little nugget that I can extract. But then I need to be able to say, hey, where does that nugget fit in this larger wall so that I can show that wall to somebody else and say, hey, look, here's how all the pieces fit together. Again, the average Joe or Joe doesn't have the time or bandwidth or probably interest in doing that. And there just aren't a lot of folks translating between one and the other.
Yeah.
So part of it is just there's a lack of interest in making the academic easy. And then to your Malcolm Gladwell piece, there's, I think, a little bit too much interest in making it a little bit too easy in that, you know, and let's take the 10,000 hours piece, which got a lot of appropriate controversy, where Malcolm Gladwell wrote up a summary of an article that said that if you practice anything for 10,000 hours, you can reach expert status. And the original author of that article quickly slapped him down and said, that's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of other academics slapped down the first article author saying, and even the 10,000 hours is a joke, that people who succeed have been good from birth, essentially, and that that nothing in that nothing in that claim rings true. So there's a lot, to your point, not just firewalls, just walls in between complicated academic language. Literally half the time I need to look up words in the title of the journals that I'm reading.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think I'm a relatively educated person. So, yeah, there's a lot in the way of getting from the science to practical application.
All right. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but I plucked out a couple things from the book that I just want you to unpack a little bit with us because I think they're really interesting. One thing you write is, quote, the less capable we are, the more delusional we are. So explain that.
Oh, there is a sad study called the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah.
And I'll tell it as quickly as I can. Two very bright scientists gave a variety of tests to about 1,000 people. They went back to the people who scored the lowest quartile on those tests, and they said, how do you think you did? And they said, well, we think we scored about the 67th percentile. And they went to the people who scored in the highest percentile, the top of the test, and they said, well, how do you think you did? And they said, well, we think we scored in about the 69th percentile. So we're all horribly unaware of our actual capabilities, mm-hmm. but the people who are, excuse the language, stupidest, are the least aware of how stupid they are. And even more challenging than the scientists went back to the people who scored really low, and they said, we're going to show you some answers. And they were showing them the right answers. They didn't tell them. We're going to show you some answers. If you'd like to choose or change any of the answers that you put down, you feel free. We're just going to show you some answers that some of the other people in the class got. What do the stupid people say? I'm not fooling, falling for that one. Well, I'm sticking with my original answers. And so the article basically said the challenge is not that you're dumb, it's that you're so dumb that you think you're actually correct.
Well, that explains a lot with everything that's going on in the world right now. Another common theme on this podcast is the idea that words actually matter. And you talk about using the word promise rather than goal. What's different about that?
Sure, and that may sound like a cute word trick. It's not intended to be. Goal setting is the single most powerful driver of higher performance. Just flat out, science is unbelievably clear. People who set bigger goals achieve more. The challenge in most settings is that we set goals with maybe a little bit less commitment than we should. Yeah, I've got 8 goals. I'll see what I can do. Certainly try to achieve them. It feels like we need to raise the seriousness level on goals. And when I'm working with my corporate clients, I say, I want to hear about the 3 promises that you're going to make to this company about what you're going to deliver this year. And it just really raises the bar because we try to make goals, but how many times do you not deliver on promises that you've made? And so just that bit of a language shift, again, it's not intended to be a word trick. It's intended to elevate in the importance of what you're doing in your mind and really make a big commitment to the organization.
So again, there's science behind the word thing. Alison Wood Brooks at Harvard once told me, because I said, this is when I started doing a lot of keynotes, I said, you know, I get nervous before these. They always go well, but I get nervous. She goes, just say you're excited, rather than say you're nervous, say out loud you're excited. And this idea that that word shift actually turns the stress I'm feeling into sort of positive stress. And that's just by, you know, saying a word out loud. And I think the same thing with promise, that you're making more of a pledge than just a sort of a benign goal.
Absolutely.
Okay, so every guest who comes on the podcast, we ask for a yes and story. This is a time in your life maybe where you normally would have said no, and you didn't just say yes, you said yes and. Do you have a story for us?
I do, and I think that it was a somewhat pivotal moment in my career when I was just kind of emerging as someone who was slightly well-known in the narrow space that I work in. And I was, again, introvert, kind of geeky, not that comfortable in front of folks. And someone who was especially well-known in this space said, hey, Mark, I'm going to be speaking at a conference. And they gave me two speaking slots and asked who I could give one of the other speaking slots to. And I'd like you to have that. And against type, I said, hey, I'm willing to do it. And what I'd love to do is a session after that with you and I together discussing this topic that you asked me to speak about. And it was really just a way of saying, hey, if I'm going to do this, let's just double down and do it as big and as effectively as I possibly can.
That's awesome. The new book is called Steps to High Performance. Focus on what you can change. Ignore the rest. Mark Efron, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kelly. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, I've been working here.